Everybody, it's time again. Grab a cup of Joe and get your friends. Put on your headphones for the Disco Posse Podcast.
Welcome, everyone, to the Disco Posse Podcast. My name is Eric Wright. I'm going to be your host today. Don't forget to keep following along. You can go to DiscoPossePodcast.com, get show notes, links, and more. You can subscribe on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher. And with that, let's get started. All right. Welcome, everybody, to the Disco Posse Podcast. We are back again, and this is an exciting opportunity. We're going to meet somebody who's new to the to this podcast, somebody who, if you're using a laptop, you've probably thought about the challenge that has been solved by this gentleman. I'm very, very happy today to welcome James Olander to the podcast. We're going to talk about a few things, and he is the creator and designer of the Roost Stand, among many other things that have happened in his life and career. Just got back from a wicked cool, outback skiing excursion. So we'll explore a bunch of stuff. We're going to talk about starting up your own design, going to a product. We're going to talk about single screen productivity, which is something that I think everybody's going to be super interested in with that. James, welcome to the podcast. If you want to introduce yourself, tell us where we can find you online, and then we're going to get started.
Yeah, thanks, Eric. Cool to be on. I created this laptop stand called the Roost, or Roost Stand. We haven't really, but I think we're still in like Facebook or the Facebook stage on naming, but like Roost laptop stand, and it's the roost stand.com. Very soon it'll just be roost.com, but a Google search of Roost laptop stand and you'll find us. And we really just sell direct. We're not in major retail or distribution, where there's no layer between us and the customer, so we get lots of feedback, and still very small, but it's like hyper product focused company, and going 6 years, 7 years now. And we spend all of our time working on new fun versions and ideas of products. So that's kind of the arc, and it got its start as a Kickstarter back in 2013.
How time flies, eh? I imagine it feels like both forever and yesterday to you from when you launched. But maybe if you could walk us through that. I think that's one of the most cool parts of this of the story here is, you know, you had an idea. And go from I think I've got an idea and executing, and then we'll talk about the actual Kickstarter, which is one of the top, Kickstarter campaigns that we've actually seen in the history of the platform.
Cool. Yeah. That is an interesting thing. And I'm an engineer by trade. So, the idea is there. And then I think a somewhat sober assessment of like all the little moving pieces that have to go into it. At least I had a spreadsheet, which with prices and is there a break even point, and when does this become any something besides a hobby? I think like a rule of thumb is I don't know anyone that's actually had a like profit from a Kickstarter until maybe their third Kickstarter. They're usually like large money losing endeavors, which I don't think that was like ever really shared too much back in the day. A lot of that was just first time mistakes and being like very bad at pricing for a proper markup and unexpected costs. I've only had two Kickstarters, so I haven't had a profitable one yet. And I think like how the platform is used nowadays is a lot more intelligently by a lot more strategically, I guess, as a list building, but as a early adopter and fans of the brand and of the product. And And I think it's still very a good way to do that. But it is a different world than it was in 2012. And you know how I got into that. I was in the right place at the right time, where I was at a place called Tech Shop. It's a members monthly membership machine shop, and it was in the Bay Area. I was living in Silicon Valley at the time, and there would literally be two or three people in the same workshop as myself that had like successful Kickstarters. And so you can just lean over and ask them, like, "Oh my gosh, how does this work? And how does that? How do you do this?" And after you see enough people around you doing, you're like, "Okay, I think I've got a most of this stuff researched a bit, and let's give it a crack." So that was the.
So was it basically? It's like an incubator for like mechanical, like physical stuff. Is that the idea of it there?
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, they went bankrupt like a year and a half ago. But the tech shop is I don't think they franchise, but they're there's a big warehouse with a bunch of machines in them. So mechanical stuff. So like a CNC machine, laser cutters, 3D printers, lots of 3D printers. Also like a huge electronics workshop. So you could solder, you could build Arduinos. They had all sorts of classes where you could learn how to use this stuff. So just like awesome hacker space. And I think the membership was like $100 a month. But like they had no equity in any ideas or whatnot. It was purely like a hangout space. And a lot of people would like spend most of their days hanging out there. It's pretty cool community. But yeah, they went out of business like a year and a half ago. So they had maybe 7 or 8 locations, I think, around the U.S. And I think they grew and couldn't make it scale. So,
alas, like anybody's first Kickstarter, they found out the hard way about funding and pricing. That's tough. That's actually, it's such an interesting space and an idea. But like, I tell you, it's the humbling thing of, you know, even when you see good revenues or good membership or a strong community wrapped around it, it's just... life is tough and business is tough. It's a different thing. You know, even the most successful product may not be the best successful business wrapped around it. It's an interesting challenge.
It is. Yeah. It was a pretty sobering thing when that happened, because the news came out of nowhere. And I mean, it's a pretty large organization. I mean, they had probably tens of thousands of members, I would think, and was known really wide. The founder, he had been interviewed by Obama when he came out to the Bay Area for like tech startup and maker spaces. And so I was going to say there's a huge hole in the marketplace that someone should fill, but maybe there isn't a hole, right? Like there is no profitable way to make that concept work, which I don't know how you'd tackle it better than those guys.
So when you managed to have a space like this, and so let's talk about the idea. When did you know that I've got a thing, that I've got a problem I think I can solve?
Right. So the thing was made clear to me by a physical hand therapist that I was seeing. I'd been an engineer at a big aerospace company, CAD jockey, like to call ourselves, and spent years just moving a mouse and driving a CAD workstation. And that finally caught up to me when I was about 26, 27, which I think that's actually a pretty common age. And I kind of see it in the conversations I'll be a part of, at whether like through Reddit or even like in-person meetups, where there's that sense of invincibility. And then the body kind of catches up, like, all the sins catch up to you around, it seems like, late 20s. And so for me, that was when my neck and my carpal tunnel symptoms really started acting up. And I was seeing a hand therapist who said, "Hey, like, it's pretty simple. You have to stop hunching at your laptop." And at the time, I'd been working for Odesk, which is now called Upwork. And they we eat our own dog food at Odesk. So we would work remote a couple days a week on our company-issued MacBook Airs. And that put me out of commission in like a month and a half, 2 months. And so now with the hand doctor telling me I can't hunch at a laptop, I started looking for portable laptop like risers or some way to get my laptop up to screen level, because often the cause of what are called repetitive stress injuries, and carpal tunnel is one of them. Often the cause is actually in your neck. And if you think of your nerves as like a garden hose, if you're pinching the garden hose right near the spigot, so like right where it's coming out of your brain, right near your C4, C5 vertebrae, if you're pinching the garden hose right there, it just causes havoc downstream. And so that's why bad posture can really catch up with you. And so concert pianists, you see them with perfect posture because they know that all the heavy load that their hands are doing needs to be fully supported by good posture all the way up to their head. So then it became pretty clear I needed to get something that got my screen up to eye level. And if you're familiar with how laptops work, the screen is attached to the keyboard and you can't like separate those two. Well, our hands aren't coming out of like the sides of our head. Our hands come out from our elbows, which are way down our body. So you have to split that paradigm up. And so I got comfortable with the idea of using an external keyboard and mouse and then raising the laptop screen up. And I was like, why isn't anyone doing this? And so in these weekend times, at tech shop, I was playing with some ideas, putting my mechanical engineering background to use, and started playing with mechanisms and laser cutters, and came up with a pretty trick folding laptop stand that once I had it, you're asking about validation. People would see me using it at tech shop, like, yeah, it's pretty cool. And so I'd have them try it, and someone would pinch their fingers here or, break this or that. So I had like a really quick feedback cycle with a bunch of tinkerers, which was pretty cool.
I could watch that GIF of the fold unfold for hours. It's like a perfect ASMR video. You could just have someone quietly talking in the background. But I just know, like, there's a lot of pinched fingers that involved the development of that design, right?
Yeah. Well, unfortunately, like, some are, are still getting pinched. We'll talk about this later, but the whole idea of this meat suit we're in, what's it capable of grabbing and moving and articulating in a kind of an intuitive way? It's a pretty hard thing to solve around. So that's what we're always trying to make it even more useful, I guess, or less, more user-friendly.
That evolution thing is neat. Like, so I love the idea that you've got the thing you got to solve. And we all know, everybody that's listening is saying like, hey, I solved this problem. I got 3 8.5 by 11, paper bundles holding my monitor up. I get like, we know we all did the same goofy thing or some cardboard box, right?
No, me too. Yeah. Yeah, I think that's like, for something to make it into your bag, or to make it on your desktop, or for an app to make it to like the first page on your app screen, it has to be like so useful and friction free that the criteria is, I think it's really simple. It's like you actually have to use it. And that was always the bar of, okay, does this thing have wings? Is it so useful that it's not a pain in the ass to use? And so, I think that's a lot harder to hit than I think our brains give it credit for, because we're, it's almost an unconscious thing that you're trying to battle on that level. So, once it got close enough where it's like, okay, I'm actually using this, then I started getting serious about, pricing out some parts and where, what suppliers can I use and how long is it going to take to make them? Where can I make them? Et cetera, et cetera.
Now, this is the interesting thing of, because of your background, did you like collaborate with other people? You were in this sort of makerspace opportunity with TechShop, but like, when did you think, like, okay, this is a thing I need to think of to be able to repeatedly create this thing and part it out. Did you go to other folks that had founded similar like products or companies? Did you that's always the weird thing is, you know, even the greatest idea to take it to a market, that's a very different thing because you're creating a business, not just a product at that point, right?
Right. And I mean, I think we're still like, you know, you have to squint to tell if we're a product or a business at this point. And which is another question too. I don't think that, are you a business or product with Amazon and the methods of distribution these days, I think you can actually squeak by as being just a product or a series of products and not a business. I think that's kind of a shift happening in the background too. But yeah, the collaboration side, I wish I had like a well laid out like rationale for how I came to that decision. But there was one point where I had a prototype and I was at some startup event, and Eric Mikofsky from Pebble was doing he's one of the panelists, and he's a tall guy, and he had spent time at Tech Shop, I think, as well, or something similar when he was working on the early prototypes with Pebble. And so I sought him out afterwards. I was like, I got to show you this laptop stand. And the first thing he said is like, you got to put this thing on Kickstarter.
Nice. Well,
when the guy who's, yeah, it was like the guy who's raised the largest Kickstarters ever, that tells you should put this on Kickstarter. That was the validation I think that I was looking for. Honestly, it was kind of like, get that done and then figure out the rest, you know, build the plane on the runway as you're around the, where, whatever that phrase is, where you're,
yeah, build a plane in air or whatever. Yeah. So this is that's a, like, talk about a great example, you know, like RIP Pebble, you know, that in itself was even
oh my gosh. Yeah.
We could spend an hour just on that challenge itself. I'd actually love to have Eric on. It's because of that, even a profoundly widely enjoyed and well-funded product developed competition. The problem with being really good is that someone else goes, hey, I'm going to take that space. I'm going to start in the competitive arena.
Yep. No, yeah. It's like, yeah, you gotta know what fight you're wandering into, and you know, big retailers, shelf space. I've got my own theories on how profitable retail is, but I'm guessing it wasn't as profitable as it needed to be, or at least their competition made it so unprofitable for them that it just squeezed the life out of it. So
there's probably I don't know any deep. See, that's one of the more popular things why, if you look at Shark Tank and stuff like that, like inevitably their entry to take 51% of your equity is always, hey, I can get you into big box retail. And that's the only, like, no one will get you there. And I kind of got to believe that there's truth to that it's difficult to enter that market. And it's also probably not something you want to do with for the first time, else you'll be on the side of a chapter 11. It's a dangerous game. It's interesting. Again, I've got huge respect, not just that you walked up bloody mountains and skied down them, but that you did this as a business and you took a run at it. Like, it's, were there points where you said, okay, everybody's liking this, but whew, you know, am I ready to actually own and operate this by itself?
And speaks to that where, you know, what you're like, is this thing, so we're selling, this is after the first Kickstarter. A great thing about Kickstarter is if you get a boatload of pre-orders, you have this wave of your own excitement and juice to ride. And you also have like thousands of people waiting on their stuff. So you're very motivated to deliver and not have egg on your face, which, you know, hacking those types of feedback loops into your product development or business cycle, I think is, you know, if you know crash and burn, you know, you gotta watch for that. But I think that was a useful thing. Like, I don't think I could have ever pushed through shipping the first version if I didn't have so many people waiting on them. It's just a different ball game of commitment. And, I've never raised funds, taken investment. Kickstarter's pre-order, but never taken like an equity outside investment. And I think of it as like not wanting to give up control, but I do see the upside in that now you've got other people to work for. And as a solopreneur, solo founder, I do think that social commitments and commitments, you know, to the more you're intertwined in the fabric of the people you're supporting, the more willing you're going to be to do whatever it takes and get up and push through solving these problems that you really don't want to work on. So I think there is value for being beholden to a lot of folks as well. That's kind of answering that part. But one, maybe the lowest point was after we had shipped. So the first Kickstarter, I think we had 3,000 units. We maybe made 5,000 total to have some inventory. And then I think over the next year, I shipped another 3,000 total. So maybe we had like shipped 8,000 to that point. And I was definitely not making money. I mean, I wasn't following it too close, but I hadn't paid myself in probably a year and a half. Maybe I had, but I think I was right at minimum wage. And there's an inflection. There's a point where it's like, well, is this a hobby or do I need to make this into a real business? And the next step was to not manufacture it myself and use a traditional mass manufacturing process. So that's injection molding is what we use. And up to that point, I had been manually running a laser cutter and we were manually like riveting these parts together. And it was extremely expensive, not profitable, but it sucked. But
that's because you probably acquired a couple of repetitive stress injuries in that process as well. Hopefully,
100%. Yeah,
your therapist on retainer.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. You solved this problem and created another one. The decision was, and actually, I'm kind of advising a friend right now that's in a similar spot with a product company, and having a product that's shipping, but it's really not profitable. What do you do? And I made the decision to stop selling the current product and only taking names for the new launch. So it's like, hey, new version's coming. Please leave your email. And I wasn't losing any money because I wasn't making any money anyways selling the current product. So there wasn't like a lost opportunity there. And not having to run a manufacturing business freed up all my brain space to work on the new one. And that was the point, I think, where I was like, okay, it's time to make this into a legit operation and involve other professional organizations such as the manufacturer that are bigger than just me running this thing. So I had now 2 years worth of, or a year and a half worth of data in terms of what's the conversion rate on the website. The Roost Stand is great in that if you've read Seth Godin's Purple Cow, it is a purple cow. Like, people see it and they're like, what is that thing? You know, tell me about that. Cause to use it, people see it. And so the word of mouth, the word of mouth marketing on it is very, very strong. And in my mind, that's been a safety net for if I can make a product that people love and want to talk about, then this whole paid acquisition side of marketing, I don't have to be that good at first, because the word of mouth is going to carry the day. And that's proven to be true. And I don't know what I would, I would have no idea what I'd do if that was not the case. Cause I definitely am not focused on that side of the business at all. So given that experience, it was like, okay, make the best next gen you can. People, if they love it, they'll talk about it. And let's just go all in on that. And then that was the second Kickstarter, which then launched in 2015. And the beautiful thing about launching to a group of people that already love your product is that you are like way ahead out the gate when you launch the next one. And that's the model that I see a lot of people using successfully on Kickstarter now, is continuing to innovate for their customer base.
Yeah, and it's the hard part is you still got to do it right the first time. And you know, a lot of people will listen to this, they're like, "Oh, I'm gonna launch a couple of junkers, and then all the third ones where I'm gonna."
Oh, right.
Like, no, you have to go all in on every one of them, and go through the course of hard yards and tough lessons and challenges in growth, you will get the third ones the break even point or whatever the profit point. It's funny. Yep. People, it's not just going out and grinding it out. You know, that just be the number three isn't what matters. It's the three proven difficult things of just doing uncomfortable stuff as an owner. You know, like you said, you're paying yourself. You can't go to Starbucks because you get paid less than the person behind the barista bar. And yep. You're doing it in faith of what you believe you can turn into something bigger. And I think the most difficult part is when you experience it, no one knows the right moments until they've long passed and you hopefully hit it. Like, yep. Knowing when to shut down is never right. Like, everybody gets, you know, most of them get that wrong. And we're usually on the wrong side of the ledger by the time we make that decision. And especially when you look at the startup success rates, you know, I'm lucky in that. I mean, I work for a startup that has experienced the right growth and a huge team. I mean, I'm just literally, I work for the company. I didn't start the company, but to see the evolution and then watch other companies around me and other products and stuff that didn't make it. And then you realize like, oh wow, when you do make it, you're a tenth of a percent of a percent. It's actually a frightening number. No one would do it voluntarily if they saw some of the stats.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that, and the longer you have success, the greater the challenge it's going to be to stay successful. It never gets easier in terms of the decisions and growth you're going to have to make. You just get practice at doing hard things. Just to make that a real feel good story.
If you're folks that are like fans of like all the motivational stuff, like David Goggins is a classic for a lot of people. Yeah, he's an interesting chap. I don't necessarily subscribe to the like, I want to make every day suck and that will make tomorrow better. But I love his mentality where people ask him all the time, like, so when does it get easy? He goes, it doesn't. It's not supposed to. that's by design. If it's never easy, it's not going to. You know, I was a spinning instructor and I'm a cyclist, and people said like, oh, it must be easier for you because you're a cyclist. I'm like, no, it's still 100% of my effort or 80% of my effort that maybe I'm kicking out a few extra percentage watts than you are. But I mean, it still sucks.
So you're practiced at it at this point. Yeah. So
when you're shipping, you're on products to, you know, what's the team? You know, this is your thing, but like, how do you reach out for stuff around learning, you know, how to handle social media, how to handle websites and conversions? How much of it did you do, and then how much did you farm out or share with other folks?
Yeah. So I subscribe to this. I think it's worked so far. Kind of hard to judge. But if there's some new thing, whether it's, on-page conversion or put some title on it that some marketing group has determined that's their thing. I've tried to get dangerous enough myself so that I can hire or contract and not be blind to maybe what's really going on. And I don't need to, the contractors I've worked with might tell you that's probably been somewhat of a challenging relationship for them, because I might meddle around too much.
You know the right questions to ask, and sometimes they wish they weren't asked those questions.
Another way, exactly. Yeah, that's a better view of it. And I mean, it's. I think one thing I think that doesn't get mentioned, and it's kind of a pet theory of mine, not mine, but it's a pet theory I'm running with at the moment, that there's all these, the internet business is not that old. It's 15 years, maybe 10 years since it's kind of reached a mass, a lot of people use the internet now for buying things, but it's not that old. And when you talk about models for businesses, there's all these different models of business. Like there's like fashion, like fast fashion, where you make something for $3, but they charge it. They have a $50 price tag on a T-shirt, and it's there for a few weeks during the release, and then it's just rapidly discounted through this this big web of different retailers as it falls down the price chain until someone tries to like break even with it at the very end at TJ Maxx or something.
I was going to say TJ Maxx. It's so hilarious. Yeah. Got there first.
Mm-hmm. You know the model. Outlet stores, outlet stores are, they give you the impression that they're collecting the overruns from their department stores, but I bet a lot of that stuff goes straight to the outlet. It's like they've got a model and they've innovated within the model. And that's just for fashion. So, but then like luxury, Rolex, is another crazy different type of luxury, business model. And it seems like people think internet is a model. But internet's not a model. Internet's just a function of one of these larger models. It's just one of the pieces that makes the larger model work. And I didn't appreciate that. And where I got in trouble is that I was trying to do all the latest things that were in vogue for funnel optimization or email, drip campaigns and maybe like a weekly flash sale or whatever it might be. And, looking back on it now, it's kind of obvious, like I need to have a type, like what kind of brand and business model do I want to represent? And how do those individual things fit into it? And some you don't even do. Like if you're a premium retailer, you don't discount. You don't have sales. Whereas like if you're Gap, everything's on sale all the time. And so they're clearly like chopped, like directing at their marketing towards a certain kind of conditioned consumer. Being very strategic on how we use all those different kind of tactics is where it's funny. It's like the agencies you hire to do those certain things, they won't tell you about what piece they play in all of this. And so that took my own kind of reading and trying to read the tea leaves of what is really going on here, after chasing my tail with some different types of marketing campaigns for a while.
It's a lesson in behavioral economics as well. I always tell people, they're like, how do you learn how to like create good products? I said, read Kahneman and Tversky first, understand how someone's going to receive the thought of your product. Then work backwards on, you know, how do I present that in a way that will work with, you know, using the principles of scarcity and prospect theory and all this other stuff. Like, you don't necessarily want to, you don't want to lead with like, I'm going to do a thing that will do these things. You're like, no, but I've got the idea. Now let's hold on for a second. How will this work? You know, like you said, go up and physically show somebody like, hey, this is really cool. Boom. Okay. Now, you know, then you know, you've got that first, you know, the first wave of they like it. They can physically touch it. There's a way I can experience it. Now let's make that repeatable and stuff like that. And then, like you said, you get into SEO and campaigns and all this stuff. And I like that you brought up the, you know, the way the retailers do their outlet stores. And I'm old enough that I grew up when outlet stores were literally like scratch and dent. It was like a misstitch. It was stuff that was first run original stuff that was sent. And it was really difficult to find because you didn't get to choose sizes. It was literally overruns, end runs, mistakes that you would buy that'd be high quality, but they were sold at cheaper prices because they couldn't sell them in the main store. But then along the way through the mid to late 80s, they discovered, oh, wait, people love these outlets. Why don't we make lower quality clothing and just send it straight to the outlets and being able to reduce the price? So it was presented like an 80% discount, but it was in fact only 20% discount because the margins were so much different because they'd lowered the quality of manufacturing. So now you're buying outlets. You're not buying original quality at outlet price. It's kind of bizarre how the market figured it out. And like, the house always wins, kids. Somewhere out there.
Yeah. No, but yeah, I guess, yeah, it's openly known. What was the name of the book you had mentioned? The author?
Thinking Fast and Slow is probably one of the best ones.
Okay. Yep.
And I'm a weird student of like behavioral economics and behavioral psychology. And that's how I got into technology, because people are like, how do you make technology, you know, work? I said, easy. You figure out how people use it and then you work backwards. And that's how it makes it easier. And I've seen, and you see it kind of play out, and it's exciting to watch, you know, folks like yourself, James, who've like done it. You took a leap of faith, you did this thing, and I'm excited by, you know, I want that third Kickstarter to take you up and over the top. Like, I want to see a team of people, you know, who are under your wing, because you've really found a lot of stuff that is great lessons that people should learn. I mean, and generally, you know, one of the productivity things that I love exposing, you know, introducing to people is just like, think about making something matter to somebody else as much as you believe it matters to you. And you know, like you said, your business, like involving other people, involving a team. That's why quite often like founders are teams, because people will believe in the ability of them to play off each other. And being a solo entrepreneur is really, really difficult, because you've got to find faith in somebody else's abilities and share this stuff. And it's that in itself is the challenge of no one else will love and care for the thing that you've got as much as you do. And when you do find somebody who kind of has that, can share that belief, they become a disciple and then they become a partner. And those are the people that you learn to latch onto. I call it my startup bus. I look around the people that I've worked with over the years and said, if I had a bus, and that's as many seats as I had, and I had to create a startup, who would be on that bus? And I got a lot of great friends that wouldn't be on that bus. And it's a tough decision to make.
Yeah. No, that's true. And to add a little color, one of the early partners of mine was the group who still does run my social media. We shared a co-working space, but a big warehouse space. We were neighbors, and that was through the first two Kickstarters. And they felt like a partner from the beginning. I mean, it's been a service contract, but it was always a, you know, any time to darken their door and brainstorm ideas by text message at, you know, 1 a.m. kind of thing. And, you know, when you're not, my thing is like the business wasn't profitable for quite a while. So it was really hard to sell anyone else on wanting to join something like that. And, you know, going forward where, you know, I think there are more opportunities to bring in, you know, to bring in folks and have them hop on the bus. But, you know, it'd be doing it where hopefully I'm not driving the bus off a cliff at this point is kind of where I'm feeling like it'd be going. So, but one thing, Ryan, who I've been working with for so long, shared is that, you know, when you're first starting out, you're working with, other, you know, in my case, I work with a lot of folks on the manufacturing partners. And we rely on them completely. And you when you're first starting out, you don't have a choice of who you work with. And that often leads to situations where you're not, you know, you don't really know what negotiating power and what position you're in. And you're often a flag kind of flapping in the breeze. And as you start to gain some success and can then use that success to work with people that you want to work with, that changes the dynamic changes just like the felt experience of working with other people. When you're working with people you don't want to work with, it's not fun. But I think there is a lot of not fun stuff at the beginning. And the idea though is that as you do find success, you can then start to pick and choose who you work with and have a lot more fun in the process too.
Yeah, there's going to be uncomfortable moments and there's a benefit on the other side of it. Some of them are just continuously uncomfortable, you know, and try and outsource some of that stuff. So now, before we wrap up, I really wanted to dig in because we talked at the start before we hit record, and these are the moments I always love to explore deeper. You talked about single page productivity. Somebody who's only using a laptop, and I'm a big fan of like close it all out and just hone in on one thing. Talk about this and what is the movement? What's the idea and what's your belief in this?
Yeah. I don't know if it has a title, maybe it does, but like single screen or something. I'm sure there is a name for it, but,
Yeah, sorry. I just realized we were talking web apps. So I think I said single page, probably. I'm stuck on a single page app phone.
Right. Yeah. Cell phones. Cell phones have managed to only have one screen, but still we are, you know, extremely hard to focus for a long period of time on a cell phone. Maybe that has something to do with it being in our hands and so small versus like a screen in front of you. The far extreme, and the devices exist now where it's a giant e-reader. You can't click into a web browser. You can't do anything that doesn't involve directly like using your pen and writing on a piece of paper, like you would in an analog world, and adapting your workflow to that paradigm. Remarkable is the name of this one tablet, and they kickstarted like a year and a half ago. I don't think that they've quite cracked the code on the workflow piece. Like it's still kind of clunky, but the whenever you have to interact with the work you're on, getting it as close to a analog equivalent, like a pen and paper, where there's something about I guess this is a little bit different than one page, but just kind of a quick aside, but something where you're actually, your hand is connected to the work you're doing. And so you get a full like motor feedback cycle that is more than just your fingers typing and then your brain trying to like figure out which characters you type. But it's actually your arm is creating the continuous stream of input.
There's definitely there's psychology behind it as well. Like that's why I'm a fan of they call it morning pages. So every morning I physically write out my goals for the day, some you know my what I'm feeling, and then at the end of the day I bust out that book and say, okay, how did the day go? It's just like 5 minutes.
Oh, good. Yep. Long,
yep. But the physical act of writing it is fundamentally different in how I act on those things down the road, because it's like you said, you're not just hacking out the words. Like I can type at an incredible rate, but when I slow down to write it out, it kind of gets you to really tune into specifically like what am I writing, and it's a very different thing if you actually did, you know, an MRI on somebody and checked a scan right while they're doing the stuff. It's remarkably different physiological responses when you actually write stuff out.
Yeah, I think it's because one theory is that your eyes are, and you're constantly monitoring the characters that are typing up, and you're looking for corrections because there's an error factor when you're typing, and then you stop your train of thought and you go correct the letters. But when you're handwriting, there's no, and yeah, you might like have some jumbled letters or whatnot, but there isn't that same editing program running when you're handwriting. Seems like that gets involved there somehow. But yeah, but it'd be really interesting to see that someone studied those differences on a neurological level.
But I definitely like this idea of like, you know, single screen and that using one thing and like the physicality of it is one thing. Even just like I think of day to day, like removing distraction, focusing in on one activity, one thing. I'm a big fan of Cal Newport's work and Deep Work is a phenomenal book. I've bought Digital Minimalism, have not yet read it. Haven't found time because I'm probably surfing the web or doing whatever. But there's a lot of research behind this stuff, and you know, and so you end up in this weird dichotomy. You know how this stuff has got to work. You know how you can make it work and like the physiology behind it. You know how like you've seen successful products and software that have achieved some of the stuff. And at the same time, hey, I got to run a business. You know, before we close out, talk about that. Like what is the dichotomy of being an entrepreneur, knowing your boundaries, but yet having to continuously push them?
I don't know if I'm qualified to answer that. I say that from like the, you know, kind of from like that funny perspective of like an ego that's trying to move beyond what it thinks it's qualified or wants things to be good, right or wrong about. I think like some awareness of what, like, you know, how does your wet hardware work through life. I've sort of come to understand that I look at the world as, you know, what's wrong with this thing, or not what's wrong, but like, how do you fix this thing? What's the thing broken? And that, I think we all have some base default pattern of looking at the world. Mine happens to be in kind of that engineer's, you know, how do I fix this thing? Or something ain't right. And if you have a little bit of insight and awareness into how that is coloring how you look at problems, then I think you stand a bit better chance of catching that pattern and maybe just getting that needle to skip a little bit a couple times to then jump out of whatever problem solving pattern I'd been in before. But a lot of times patience and knowing that how I'm thinking about it now is going to change, and that sometimes the best thing is just a couple days away on a weekend, not thinking at all about the problems. If I can have that thought, like trying to hold on to that thought, because I think the thinker we all have in our own heads, like, you know, if you hammer on that thing all the time and everything's a problem to solve and you're always thinking, then that pattern gets deeper and deeper ingrained into how you look at everything. And so being able to step back from that and allow other ways of problem solving and looking at the world to come in is always good. That's about all I got though. I wouldn't say, I don't have any more, sage things on that.
I think it's that tough, enough though, is if sure. Anybody just took that few minutes of advice and put it into play, you know, once a week, it is meaningful. So James, thank you very much. This has been a pleasure. I could definitely, we'll catch up again. I want to hear about the next, I know there's something coming and I know it's going to be big.
So yeah.
I want to be a part of that launch, you know, definitely let's keep in touch. We'll share stories. How do folks get a hold of you if they want to follow along and hear about what your latest activities are?
Yeah, no, thank you for having me on and would love to keep you in the loop. And we do have some stuff coming. Don't know when though. But the website, the roofstand.com, if you send an email to us there or contact us, it goes right to me. So that's the best way. And we're also on Twitter and Facebook. So find us on any of those platforms.
Well, when you're not walking up mountains, skiing down them, creating successful Kickstarters, take that time, slow down. It's been a pleasure, James. Thanks very much for taking the time with us today. And folks, of course, definitely reach out, follow along to what James is doing. This has been super good advice and look forward to chatting in the future.
Cool. No, thank you so much, Eric. It's been great chatting.
You're listening to the Disco Posse Podcast.